This is a continuation of the oral history interview with Michael Goldberg, Emeritus Director of the Union Theater. Today is February 22nd, 2006. Michael, we were just finishing your early 70s at the last interview, and so if you could talk a little bit about where you went from there to when you took over the theater.
Yeah. As I said, I started out as a stagehand. I'd worked on the program staff of the union, responsible for film programming at the union in the late 60s, as well as administrative support for Bill Dawson, who was the director at that time. Mm-hmm. I left Madison. I came back to Madison at the invitation of Fan Taylor, who at that time was running the Arts Presenters Association, then called ACUCAM, Association of College and University Concert Managers. It was one of those auxiliary enterprises at the university where it was a freestanding, independent organization. But as administrative support, everybody who worked at the Presenters Association was a university employee, what I've often called the parasites on the great whale. The parasites serve the great whale of the university very, very well, and the university serves them, but it's a laissez-faire kind of thing. When I came back to Madison, I was invited to come and do a project for which the funding had not yet been secured, so I came back and took a part-time job as a projectionist at the Union Theater. Then when the funding came through, I left that and I went to work for the association. Based here in Madison, housed at Keystone House, now the old Squire Petherick's house that goes back to the 1840s here in Madison, now the home of the Max Kade Institute for Deutsches Kultur. Across the street from the Unitarian Meeting House. It's a university facility. So that was my offices. But I really wasn't, at that time, I really truly was not working for the university. I was being payrolled by the university. We did a one-year study in a dozen different states, North and South Dakota, Nebraska and Kansas, South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama and Mississippi, and West Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, Arizona, and Southern California. And the study addressed recital programming, literally classical music and recital programming in university program environments, and opportunities to expand that program, those programs and audiences, and do development. It was an incredible year-long odyssey for me, and I won't go into that because it was kind of just my personal journey. Just suffice it to say that I got to visit the entire country.
Wow.
I mean, I drove over the course of the next 10 months to 38 campuses in these dozen states. And I literally drove every place. I bought a little Volkswagen Squareback for the purpose of this journey. And because I would be at a campus for 2 days or so, or 3 days, I'd set it up in Madison and I'd go out on the trip. And I'd go out for 2 weeks at a time, sometimes three, then come back and then go out again. When I did the long western leg of the trip, I actually took my break when I was in New Mexico. I flew home for a couple of days. I flew back out and continued the trip. But it was a great journey. It would typically take 1.5 to 2.5 days at each institution that I visited, interviews and contacts with people, with time in between, plenty of time to drive from one place to the next. So I stopped at every single historical site, national monument, landmark, roadside marker, anything. And I just stopped and I took it in. It was just amazing. I mean, I was at Fort Union in Arizona. I was standing in Kansas looking at the Santa Fe Trail wagon tracks across the prairie. I was at all of these wonderful places in Alabama that are associated with the Civil War. I visited, I even took a side trip because I had 2.5 days to get from San Angelo, Texas, to Santa Fe, New Mexico, which takes about 3/4 of a day, and it was Friday, and I didn't have to be in Santa Fe, New Mexico, Las Vegas, New Mexico until Monday. So I took a 200-mile detour, and I drove to Carlsbad Caverns in New Mexico, which is way down in the southern part of the state. It was a great trip. I had a wonderful time. The study was pretty successful. Came back and reported a lot of things that didn't surprise anybody but hadn't really been documented anywhere. And this is relevant to the Union Theater too, because what the study said was that the one night stand, the visiting guest artist, could be better replaced by the half week or full week residency engagement with ancillary activities and run-up interactions before the concert, focusing on young artists who would come into a community, make connections, had the facility to do outreach activities, and then culminate in a public concert for which some of the groundwork and attendance had been cultivated. This is not new information these days, but back in the early 70s, the only organization in the country that was doing anything even like this was something called Affiliate Artists. So this worked pretty well. The study came back and reported that if inroads into building young audiences for classical music and chamber music and recitals in particular were going to be made, this might be one way to go about it. Mm-hmm. The second year of the work for the association was a further grant that provided funding for a kind of project based on the findings of the studies, where program professionals went into environments where classical music and chamber and recital programming was not thriving. They did some administrative workshops to teach this work to local organizations, local administrators, usually volunteers, sometimes university, followed by a 1 or 2 week residency by a young artist who would do the kinds of activities that the study had recommended might work for cultivating audiences.
Oh, I see.
The relationship to the Union Theater is that at that time, this would be 73, 74, Bill Dawson, who had become the director of the Union Theater some years before, bought into the findings and recommendations of the study. So the Union Theater, which had been hosting the Union Concert Series since 1939, in the late 60s and especially in the early 70s and later 70s following this report, aggressively pursued this kind of artist-in-residence outreach programming in conjunction with regular one-off concerts and recitals and performances. Mm-hmm. So Dawson became a kind of committed host for this kind of programming, and hence made the Union Theater kind of an exemplar of a commitment to this kind of residency program. Again, nothing that is unique now, mm-hmm. but in the early 70s it really wasn't being done very much. What's also interesting about that is that I had left the Union Theater in the late 60s, and I think I mentioned before that Ralph Sandler had succeeded me in that job.
Right.
Well, Ralph was working for Bill Dawson when Bill bought into this programming concept for the Union Theater. When Bill left the Union Theater in 75 and Ralph Sandler became the program director, he continued this programming initiative at the Union Theater, making it a very, very committed outreach programming, residency programming vehicle. And in fact, when I came back to the Union Theater, when I returned to Madison in the late 70s, Ralph was still doing that, and one of my responsibilities when I came back to work for him was to implement many of these residency and outreach programs. So I was actually implementing the kinds of programming that 8 years before I had done research suggesting ought to be where programs should go.
How interesting, Michael.
Yeah.
And how satisfying.
Well, there was some linkage there.
Yeah.
And just a little footnote to that is when Ralph Sandler left the Union Theater in 1980 to come to the Madison Civic Center as its first director from the time it opened, there had been a couple of directors before the opening, he in turn carried that residency and programming commitment, outreach program commitment, to the Madison Civic Center. Again, now almost all performing arts centers and campus program venues do that sort of thing. But in the early 70s, when the study was conducted, it was fairly early along.
So, Michael, when you finished that study, it sounds like you then again left Madison.
Yeah, in 1975, end of 75, when the project, you know, the study was 73, 72, 73, 73, 74, middle, later 74, I said, you know, 73. Sorry, 71, 72 was the study. 72 to 73 was the project. Late in 73, I deluded myself once again into thinking that my time in Madison was up and I better move on. So I went looking for other work, and I found a job in New York. I worked for a service organization in New York called Opportunity Resources, which was basically it was a nonprofit arts placement service for administration professionals in the arts, not performing artists, but administrators. Because by that time, the mid-70s, although there'd been people doing the work of the arts for many, many years, other than artwork, they weren't called arts administrators. They were called impresarios, they were called concert managers, whatever. By the mid-70s, the notion of arts administration as a profession and as an identifiable field of endeavor had started to kind of crystallize. And in fact, unrelated to me, I'm sure you'll get to this at some point, Fan Taylor, once again, was instrumental, along with Al Prevey, E. Arthur Prevey, in the School of Business, for creating the Arts Administration Program, an MBA program at the UW, which basically in the late 60s and early 70s said, arts administration is a professional field of endeavor and should be degreed and credentialed in a academic and professional studies sort of way. The Arts Admin program at the UW, by the way, it was one of the two oldest in the country. The only one that preceded it was the Arts Admin program at UCLA. But they had a hiatus, and then they resurrected it. So in fact, to my knowledge, the program that Art Prevey and Fan created and that Art ran for many, many years, and that Andrew Taylor is the director of now, is the oldest extant and ongoing graduate program in arts administration anywhere in the country. And that's probably a field of inquiry for you anyway as part of your history research, because now, after over 35 years, the numbers of really successful and prominently situated arts administrators around the country running major programs and major facilities all over the U.S., the number of those people who are graduates of the Arts Admin program at the university is very, very substantial. I'm talking about the director of the Mondavi Center in California and the Blumenthal Center in North Carolina and so on. So that's another one of those things, you know, and again, all due credit to Fan Taylor, who worked with Al Prevey to create this little kernel of a program, which 35 years later has the university's tentacles all over the country in arts, professional arts administration. Not everybody in the program went into the arts. Some people did other things, but many, many, many of them ended up with important arts administration jobs. And Kathy Dwyer is a prime example. You know Kathy because she's been on the, I think she's on the LNS Board of Visitors or something like that.
Oh, that's right. She is. Kathy Dwyer Southern?
Kathy Dwyer Southern, right. Major, major, long-time, multi-decade professional career in arts administration as a graduate of that program as well. Anyway, so I went to New York for about 2.5, 3 years, 3.5 years. Took some time off in the mid-70s for bad behavior. When I was finished in New York, I said to people, you know, I grew up in here in New York. I don't think I want to stay in the city anymore. The 70s were not a great time in New York. The city was in rough shape through that period. So I went out to California, and I stayed with a friend of mine. Also a graduate of the University of Wisconsin. He was a psychiatrist who had taken his medical degree at the university and whom I had known also in the 70s. he lived in Los Gatos in one of these redwood wonders that hangs off a cliff and looks out over the Pacific Ocean. So I went out there and I just hung out. It was very nice, very nice indeed. I went up to San Francisco, which is about an hour and a half away. I poked around there. I actually was offered a job with Western Opera Theater, which was at that time the touring arm of the San Francisco Opera, which I declined. And my friend Harry said to me, "You turned it down?" And I said that I realized that I probably didn't. He said, "You had a job in San Francisco." And I said, "Well, I guess what I realized is that I didn't really want a job in San Francisco. I probably just wanted to prove that I could get one." And I just packed up my bags one day, and I came back to Madison. As a matter of fact,
Without a job.
But when I was leaving Opportunity Resources, which, remember, was a placement service, it was a headhunting firm, and people said, "Well, you leave here, you should have your pick of jobs, right?" And I just walked out the door, and I went to California to hang out, and I didn't find the job. And I walked back into Madison, and I remember coming in on a very, very hot, it was an early September day, it was the start of the school year. And I had friends who were still here, and I remember getting off the bus and walking into town with my suitcase. And I was broke, I didn't have a job. I stayed with friends. In fact, I stayed with Jeff Golden.
Oh, you did?
I didn't even have my car. What happened was, when I moved, there's no reason to own a car in New York.
Right.
So before I left, I had taken my car, I think I got the sequence right, I'd taken my Volkswagen Beetle, and I parked it in a kind of shed, a garage, behind the house of some friends who lived just south of Madison, outside of Oregon, town of Dunn. And I came back, and the car was still there in their garage. It had been there for like 6 years. It was covered with bird droppings. But it was a Volkswagen, right?
Yes.
So I got in, and I turned the key, and it started.
Amazing.
So I figured, well, I came back to the right place. So I didn't have any work, so I got a job driving taxi, which is an honorable profession in Madison. As a matter of fact, almost a third of all Madison's important citizens have driven cab at one time or another.
Well, certainly all of the PhDs in philosophy.
I drove cab for what was then Checker Cab, just as they were going under and disappearing, and just in the transition to the creation of what is now Union Cab.
Uh-huh.
In fact, I remember I went to some of the organizing meetings. I never, except for like a week, I never really worked for Union Cab, because by that point I'd found other work. But during that about 1 year period, I needed to do what all. So I actually, in addition to driving cab, I was the manager of the Wisconsin Chamber Orchestra.
And I didn't know that.
Yeah, I did that for about a year. That was during the David Crosby era, middle of the David Crosby era. It's actually working with the Chamber Orchestra that I met my wife in the, I think it was in 76, she was singing Mad Margaret in a Savoyard's production of Ruddy Gore, which I saw. So, of course, I married Mad Margaret. People said, well,
and for the record, this is Alice Ann Apple.
It is, my mezzo-soprano wife. Then later on, I actually got the hand for a paycheck, because later that year, she was doing a solo part in a performance of Messiah that David Crosby was conducting.
Oh.
And I was the manager of the orchestra, so I gave her a check. Worked wonders. So I worked for David. I also had a Thursday afternoon classical music program on WORT, which at that point was only a few years old. It was, you know, we're talking about 1977 now. It was kind of brand new. And I did that little combination of stuff for a few years with gracious support from David Crosby. I got to direct some Savoyard's productions over the next few summers.
Oh.
Carlos Moser at the University Opera, who had let me do some directing for him in the early 70s, let me, in fact, direct for the opera in the late 70s as well, and the early 80s. So that was my first best love. I have a cartoon someplace. It's not on the bulletin board here. And it shows a seal, a circus seal, balancing a balloon on its nose. And it's got a rack in front of it with a horn and a bell and a whistle, you know. It's like a one-man band thing. and the seal is on one of these circus pedestals, and underneath the seal is saying, "Yes, but what I really want to do is direct." So that was me.
Yes, indeed.
But anyway.
Did Fan Taylor know you were back in town?
Fan indeed did know that I was back in town. But at that point, Fan had was working part-time for the university as the first director of what was then called the Arts Consortium. That was something that was created under Ed Young's chancellorship. Mm-hmm. And Fan was the first coordinator of the Arts Consortium, which was basically an entity designed to link up all the arts departments in the university, which, as you know, are scattered all over the place. Mm-hmm. You got music and theater in the College of Letters and Science, and the dance program was in Phi Ed and the School of Education, and they're just all over the place, and the LVM had opened at that time. So Fan's job as the head of the consortium was to bring the representatives and directors of all these departments and units together to see if the arts could operate collaboratively in a university environment. And there was actually serious talk for the university about creating a College of Arts, but that never really materialized. That probably would have been too centralized for a university like Wisconsin anyway, but the real difficulty was all these entities were already, for a century, had been ensconced in their respective colleges, mm-hmm. and the trauma to the structure system wouldn't have worked. So Fan was here, and what happened was that in, would have been late 77, Ralph Sandler hired me to come back into the job that I had vacated for him. Remember what I said before, yes. Is that I was working for Bill Dawson. When I left, Ralph took my job. When Dawson left, he took Dawson's job. By 77, the job that we had both held was vacant, and he hired me back. So basically, we changed places in the parade.
Interesting.
And so I came back to the union. I said I had some of the film programming. I had much of the residency-related activity work. I picked up on the Travel Adventure series, which has been a mainstay of the university and union theater programming for decades. Mm-hmm. And then in late 79, Ralph became a candidate for the first director's job at the Madison Civic Center, which opened in December of 1980. And when Ralph left, I was asked to be the interim program director of the Wisconsin Union Theater.
Who asked you, Michael?
Ted Crabb, who was the director of the Wisconsin Union. And I worked for Karen Johnson Matthews, who was the assistant director for programming at the union. Then in the early 80s, I went on for a couple of years as program director of the Union Theater. A little step back here. Fan, for 20 years, had been the director of the Union Theater. Dawson, yes. had been the director of the Union Theater. Ralph Sandler was the program director of the Union Theater. And he reported to Karen and Ted Crabb on the program side of the union, while Jim Kensler was the operations manager, and he reported to Tom Smith at the union, to the associate director. But there are people who said, that the director of the Union Theater really shouldn't be a servant of, shouldn't, you shouldn't have two servants of two masters. Mm-hmm. You should have one servant of two masters.
Yeah.
So when Kensler retired in 1983, he put the jobs back together again, and I became director of the Union Theater. Mm-hmm. So I was program director of the Union Theater for about 2.5 years, and I was director of the Union Theater from 83 to 2003 for 20 years when I left to come to Overture.
Mm-hmm. Were you thrilled, Michael, to get the job as director of Union Theater? Do you recall?
I was pleased. I was very pleased. I was especially pleased that the job had been restructured as the director, because the feeling was, my feeling was, a lot of people's feelings, especially Ralph Sandler, Bill Dawson, and Fan Taylor, all of whom were around, that the theater needed a director who was responsible for the entire enterprise, not a program director and an operations director who were parallel but had different sectors of responsibility. That the programming, that the operations person ought to report to a theater director. And yes, I was very happy, I was very pleased to get it. When it became a single job, I felt that that was kind of a completion of something that should have been happening all along. It was one of those funny moments where I suddenly realized, well, maybe this is what I was supposed to do all along. After walking into that theater in October of 1960, and here it was 23 years later, and they made me the director of it. And I even tried to go away two or three times, and for whatever reason, I didn't come back to the Union Theater.
I understand,
I just came
Michael.
Back to Madison, but I ended up back in the Union Theater a second time, and you know, first a stagehand, then a program staff person doing films, then a projectionist, then a program staff person doing residency stuff, then the program director, then the director. So there was an evolution to that, and it was kind of like, well, my work has taken me to this place. But I told you, I have this point of view on the way your life plays out, that there's a kind of, it's pretty chancy. You never really know what circumstances are going to come together. And that's the way it played out for me. It was amusing, too, by the way, because I said for many years, and I said it jestingly because they were very supportive, but I would say to people, I am the fourth director of the Union Theater. Fan did it for 20 years. Dawson did it for 6 years. Sandler did it for 5 years. And here I am. All three of these people live within walking distance of this theater, and they don't hesitate to call me up and tell me whether I'm doing my job right. Now, the truth of this is they never did that. They never called me up to ask me to tell me what they thought about how I was doing the job. But they were, all of them, very, very supportive in those years to follow. And that brings us to the Union Theater.
This concludes side two of tape three. This is a continuation of the oral history interview with Michael Goldberg. It's tape number four, side one, February 22nd, 2006.
Bob, I'd like to focus on the Union Theater now. I want to go out of two ways. I want to talk a little bit on the front end about the Union Theater in the context of the university, just briefly, and then also in the context of the Wisconsin Union, which is a story unto itself, and then later on kind of go through the my time in the Union Theater kind of chronologically.
Perfect.
When I left the Union Theater in January of 03, my last day was Friday the 31st of January of 03. And when I told everybody I was leaving, they said, well, what do you want to do for going away? And I said, well, I don't really want to do much of anything, but how about if we have kind of open house and just let people stop by if they want to, you know, stop by and say thank you and so on. So we had an open house on the Union Theater stage on Thursday the 30th of January. I think you were actually there.
I remember.
And Lamar Billups, who works for the Chancellor, in the Chancellor's office now, and who coincidentally, by the way, is on my board of directors here at Overture. Mm-hmm. But Lamar was there, representing the Chancellor's office, and also knowing that I was going away, and he kind of had an inkling that I might be a candidate for the job at Overture, so he was kind of sniffing me out, as it were. But he came to me in the middle of that afternoon, and I was absolutely overwhelmed, because I got to tell you, there were, I don't know, hundreds of people.
Oh, yes.
Hundreds. It was quite touching. As a matter of fact, you may recall that at one point, the staff had pulled together some memorabilia, some posters and some stuff to lay around, and there was some, you know, jokey things as well. And at one point, the Pro Arte Quartet walked in, whom I'd had some cordial dealings with. And they just sat down and they played a Mozart string quartet.
Yeah, it was wonderful.
It was very touching. But anyway, Lamar says to me, he's looking around, and Lamar didn't really know me. We'd only met one time, very briefly, a couple of years before, and he says to me, "Everybody is here." And I said, "Well, I'm not sure what you're referring to." But she said, "Well, the arts people are here, the union people are here. There are people from the College of Agriculture, there are people from the School of Education, there are people from the Extension, there are people from everybody in the university." Dr. Watts's face from our Cancer Research Center.
Carbone?
Paul Carbone was there. There was somebody there from the Wiseman. He said, "What are they all doing here?" And I said, "You have to understand that at some time, everybody at the university needs the Wisconsin Union Theater for something. And when they need it, typically, they need it for something which is not what they ordinarily do. It's a performance, it's a presentation, it's a gathering, it's got a theatrical or performance component to it. In other words, you got scientists and poli-scientists and English literature specialists and ag people, and they need to come into a theater for some reason. And the Union Theater is their theater for that purpose. And since they're kind of out of their element, they are very dependent on the Union Theater and its staff to get done what needs to be done to make their program reason for being there successful. They don't really know anything about putting on a performance. God only knows they don't know anything about hanging any lights and hooking up the sound system for performance purposes, let alone staging and whatever. And whether it's a straight-up conference, like the conferences that the Union Theater hosts every summer, the scientific conferences, you know, the luminescence conference and the biosciences conferences, math conferences, or a fundraiser, or an awards presentation, or the Alumni Association giving out its Distinguished Alums Awards, or whatever. They come into the Union Theater needing a theater. And my staff would make their shows succeed, would make them look really good. And usually, when they had a reason to come, we not only had, almost in most cases, I would like to think in every case, done great work for them, but it was a special event. It was a very important or high profile or out of context activity for their unit or department or whatever. So their association with the Union Theater was kind of a highlight for them, and their appreciation for the experience that they had there was grounded in the special circumstances that had brought them there in the first place. And that's all over and above the ones who came because they went to performances and concerts and events at the Union Theater. But when they called up and said, "Oh my God, so-and-so is coming in to visit from, you know, Zurich," or "We're hosting a lecture by God only knows who," or the poli-sci people, you remember, the union hosted that political forum on healthcare.
Yes.
With the governor of Colorado and Donna Shalala and a bunch of other people. People would come to the Union Theater and say, "We need to do an event. We don't know anything about doing an event, let alone in a theater environment." So everybody was there. Well, that's the point. I said to Lamar, is sooner or later, everybody at this university ends up needing and using the Union Theater for something. And that's why they all showed up. Not for me personally, but because of the experience of theirs that the Union Theater had kind of, you know, accomplished for them.
Although there is a personal component to it, Michael, because you will let me say that my experience with you, and I'm sure everyone else's, was, "What do you need, Bob?"
Yeah. Well, and
which was what you did.
Yeah, not a problem. I'll take credit for that. I'll give due credit to my staff, who are the ones who really pulled it off. Mm-hmm. But in fact, what that speaks to is the service side of the Union Theater as an entity at the university. Mm-hmm. And it goes way, way beyond. There are plenty of other service environments at the university. I mean, you know, the Wisconsin Center and the Fluno Center and the Cole Center and all the rest of them. Mm-hmm. But the Union Theater has always been just the right size for so many things that happen in it. Yeah. And whether it was, the Distinguished Lecture Series or a Chazen Lecture or one of those, you know, during the 1991-92 presidential campaign, and Bill Clinton was in there doing one of his onstage town forum things that he did.
Oh, was he? I forgot that.
As a matter of fact, let's take a little sidebar here. You know, it is awful when the famous politicians come to visit. For one thing, the feds come in from Milwaukee and the regional offices 2 days ahead of time. They sweep the building, they empty the lockers, they got dogs sniffing around, they got SWAT teams on the roof. It is a total pain in the neck. Yeah, secret passages so we can drop them off here, and nobody ever see them going in there, and they walk them through the bowels of the building and up to the Union Theater, you know, nobody's ever going to find them. So Bill Clinton did this thing during the campaign, he and Al Gore together. I think it was Clinton alone. I can't remember. I know it was Clinton. Well, then he got elected, and about a year and a half later, remember they had their kind of youth service program that the Clinton administration had proposed? And Al Gore came back to roll out that program on the Union Theater stage, right?
Oh.
It was the first place, remember this vaguely?
Yeah, vaguely.
And he made his presentation
about this rollout.
That's right, right? So here we are, a year and a half later, the elections are over, and the feds are back. And we said, we don't want to see you again. There's not another election for another 3.5 years. What are you doing here? Go away. Don't come back for another 3 years. This happened regularly. We had the same deal with Judge Rehnquist when he came to speak at the Union Theater. It just turns your life upside down.
Was it that way when the Chazen Lecture brought Jimmy Carter back?
Yep, absolutely.
Even though he was no longer president?
He's got federal security with him. He's got, you know, federal agents with him, and they do vote. It's not quite as voluminous as when a sitting president or a vice president shows up. There was a little less of it with Rehnquist, but there was plenty of it. I give you an example of how it was. You know, the Union Theater sits over the Hoofers Outing Club facilities downstairs in the basement and out towards the lakefront. Well, the day before, all the Hoofers had to vacate their lockers and be out of the lockers that are all underneath the lobby end of the Union Theater out towards the lakefront.
This was for Rehnquist?
This was for Al Gore.
Oh, for Al Gore. Oh, these lockers, vice president.
Yeah. These lockers have to be empty. If they're not empty, by the day before the visit, we will come through with the cutters and take all the locks off. They did pay for the locks that they had to remove, but they cleared all the lockers. Nobody could go into the building except with a special pass during that now lockdown period of time. And then they brought the dogs in to sniff all the lockers to see if there were any bombs or chemicals to be found. It's just loony. So that's one extreme. Opposite extreme, of course, is something like the Milwaukee Symphony or the Bill T. Jones Dance Company or rock and roll. See, one of the splendors of working in the Union Theater was that you could come to work 5 or 6 nights in a row, and on 5 or 6 nights in a row find 5 or 6 totally different, totally unrelated activities, and 5 totally different unrelated audiences who would be aghast to find themselves in the building on the wrong night. Because, you know, on Tuesday night it would be the travel film, and that was the halt and the lame, you know, the elderly crowd, the seniors. Although I will say about the travel film, we'll talk about those later, is that there were people who came to the travel film because they were brought by their grandparents. And 25 years later, these same people were bringing their grandparents to the travel films. Uh-huh. So there's that audience. But you come back the next night, and here's a lecture by Scott Momaday. And you come by the next night, and there's a rock and roll event. And you come by the night after that, and there's a film premiere. You come by on Friday night, and it's the Emerson String Quartet. And you come by on Saturday, and it's something else. You know, and it's, you know, Sam Kinison, one of the worst, most vulgar and unpleasant people in the world, stand-up comic, right? Mm-hmm. So what I'm saying is that for the people who worked in the Union Theater, it was this constant parade of variety. Some of it was tedious, some of it was just work. But I can't tell you how many incredible lectures by amazing and important people I heard at the Union Theater, because the Union's distinguished, the Forum Committee, now the Distinguished Lecture Series Committee, would bring in what any university is expected to bring in, important, high-profile, eminent speakers on erudite and, you know, on profound subjects. And there it was, and I come to work and I get to listen to all this stuff.
Michael, did you make it a point of going to most things in the evening?
Yes. Yeah. Not every evening. Couldn't do it every evening. And I do still do that now. Mm-hmm. But you have to know what's going on, you know. It's a lot of nights and weekends. Mm-hmm. Many, many nights and weekends. The nice thing, of course, is that if it's all show business, then you can say, well, I'm not working, I'm watching the show. But the truth is, you're always working.
Yes.
Al San and I would go to all the concert series events. And it would take an act of will to sit down in the seat and not be working, but just going to the concert. And for the most part, I was able to do that. But we'd be sitting there, and it's 8:05, and the concert hadn't started, and I'm saying, why aren't they taking the house lights down? There must be a problem backstage. You sit here, dear. I'm going to go back and take a look and see what the problem is. She'd say, I thought you were coming to the concert. I didn't know you were working tonight. But for the most part, I did get to the point. You know, and I have to say that I had, you know, total confidence in my staff to do what needed to be done, so I didn't have to be standing there making sure that the house lights went down and the curtain went up on time. That was their job. But it was all of the stuff, and it was Savoyards doing Gilbert and Sullivan in the summertime, and it was, you know, local groups doing events there when they could find a date, which is part of the discussion. So the Union Theater really was this kind of, I used to say, a theater, and this theater in particular, is just a big empty space filled with nothing but opportunity. And it's really people's responsibility to fill that space and make it come alive. And it would do that night after night, year after year. It did it for years before I got there. It's been doing it for years since I left. The fact that it was blessed with a fabulous design has made it an incredibly efficient and adaptable and functional theater, so that so many different kinds of things could be incorporated and presented in there. There's a thing in Fan Taylor's book about the year that they hosted the NCAA weightlifting final competition on the Union Theater stage, right? And I remember doing a production there. I think it was Bill T. Jones or something else. It was this big upstage scaffolding with triple screens and multiple slide projectors, you know, one of these multi-image things, right? Well, the technology made all that possible, but the fact is that the Union Theater was built in 1939.
I know.
Nobody who built the theater in 39 was planning on triple screen rear projection multimedia presentations in the space. And yet it turned out, when it came time to do it, the people who set this up said, this theater is perfect for what we're doing. The dimensions are just right. The distances, the throws, the angles, everything else just made such great sense. They were ecstatic because the facility worked so well for that. And then, of course, the Guarneri String Quartet, who said, boy, this is one of the best places we've ever played.
Really?
This is a hall that was designed so well that it has served incredibly for an unbelievable range of activities over the years. It is malleable, it is adaptable. Now, it's got its problems these days. It's now, you know, 65, almost 70 years old. And, you know, kind of like me, you know, it's a little creaky and it's leaking in a few places, stuff like that. But the essence of it, the configuration, the audience flow, the angles of the ceiling, you sit in the balcony of the Union Theater and you understand that there's walls that taper towards the stage.
Yes.
And that ceiling that curves down towards the proscenium, even the little architectural fins down the middle that are just really an architectural and an acoustic and a design element. Everything is designed to enhance and reinforce that linkage between the audience and the stage. Performers go out on that stage and they look around. They realize that they're in a space where they are absolutely as connected as a theater will allow you to be with your audience. And I can't tell you how many times over the years artists would come off the stage and say, this is a great space to play in. The theater people could walk out on stage and own every corner of the auditorium.
Mm-hmm.
That's that, what I'm talking about is, you know, that feeling you're sitting in the theater and somebody's on stage performing for 1,000 people.
Yes.
And your experience is that they're performing just for you.
Yes.
Theater people can own the Union Theater. The acoustics are ideal for spoken word. For music, the acoustics are a little dry. It's not a very resonant space, but it is absolutely bell clear. It is crystal clear. You can hear a pin drop. When I say it's a little dry, it's not terribly resonant. You know, the decay time for sound is short. The decay time in the New Overture Hall for the symphony acoustically is like over 2.5 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
The decay time in the Union Theater is about half that before a sound that you hear disappears entirely.
Although, Michael, I can remember when I worked for Madison Opera and I saw their production of Man of La Mancha.
Mm-hmm.
It was exquisite.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about what the opera did, but being in the hall and hearing it,
yeah.
I remember that performance.
Yeah, no, it's incredibly singer-friendly. It's incredibly chamber music-friendly. It's not great for orchestra. One of the problems is on the stage, because it's a stage house, the bigger the ensemble gets, the harder it is for the people on stage to hear one another. Also, the Union Theater never had a real concert shell. It's got a concert shell. It's basically fiberglass, you know, it's like, you know, an inch, you know, half an inch thick. A real concert shell is, you know, 2 feet thick, has an enormous amount of reverberation, of hard surface for sound to reverb off of. But everything was absolutely perfectly clear. The dance people loved it. Didn't work for Swan Lake, it was too small.
Mm-hmm.
But for almost all modern dance, which in fact started to emerge kind of simultaneously with the life of the Union Theater, the proportions of that proscenium, you know, 36 across, 30 high, you know, looked just right. And for years, all kinds of modern dance looked terrific on that stage because the proscenium framed it so beautifully. So, you know, it was the whole ball of wax. The theater stuff, the performances, the lectures, the other kinds of uses. Union Theater was being used 300 plus days a year.
Really?
And on many days it was for 2 and sometimes 3 activities. Depending on how you count it, the Union Theater was arguably used, in my era, more than 700 times a year.
Hmm.
Where you'd have a lecture in the afternoon and a concert at night. Or a rehearsal in the morning and a concert in the afternoon and a movie at night.
Michael, before we leave the theater per se itself, would you say that it's one of the best such venues in the United States?
It always has been. Now, the problem is that it was acknowledged as such when it opened in 1939.
Yes.
When you got to the mid-60s, the great era, the new era of theater building was well underway. And in that regard, the new venues, even in the 60s, let alone now, just way surpassed the Union Theater and what it could accommodate in the way of technology. But the Union Theater was kind of prototypical in many ways. For example, the back of the Union Theater, the back of the mezzanine, there are the glass panels that separate the booth, the area backstage there. Those areas in what is called the chair circle can be closed off. There are plate glass windows that can be cranked up and down mechanically. You know, it's like a capstan on a ship. It's exhausting. But you can raise and lower those panels. They were designed so that the Union Theater could be a learning laboratory, so that people could be back behind those panels, listening over speakers to the program, and being able to talk without the audience hearing all the chatter. Mm-hmm. Well, almost all theaters have control booths now, and those booths back there were actually conceived as kind of educational environment, but they also have patch panels back there that link under the sidewalk directly to Wisconsin Public Radio. So you could broadcast from the Union Theater simply by plugging into the wall. Right?
Wow.
That was in 1939.
Amazing. Okay? Really amazing.
Yeah. Similarly, the theater was designed by a guy named Michael Hare. The theater, the Union Theater, actually has elements in it that remind one of Radio City Music Hall. Now, it's obviously not like Radio City. Yes. Radio City has 6,000 seats in it, you know, this mega facility. But if you look at some of the architectural elements, the brass railings that run here and there, Michael Hare was not a big-time architect. He was an emerging young architect. He worked for the firm that designed Radio City. He did not, and I'm pretty sure this is in Fan Taylor's book, I believe. I think I got this right. The reason the Union Theater is so incredibly functional is because of the theater consultant on it, who was, Christ, I can't believe I lost his name. It'll come back to me. Okay. Who worked for Theater Guild.
Oh.
In New York, worked for the Lunts, as a matter of fact.
Really?
And is connected with the Theater Guild in New York, which, of course, is one of the reasons why the Lunts were there on opening day, because, actually, the Lunts were there on opening day because they had a good connection to the professor who was the chair of the theater department in the 30s. I'll give you another example of the Union Theater's uniqueness as a physical performing arts venue. Theater controls, theater lighting controls, are usually managed with dimmers.
Mm-hmm.
The theater consultant was Lee Simonson. Lee Simonson is the reason why the loading doors off Park Street roll down a ramp and immediately onto the stage without any distance between the load-in and the deck itself.
Wow.
He's the reason that everything is so compressed and accessible. The Union Theater, even for security reasons, you know, it's got those funny spillways on the side.
Yes.
You drop the curtain and you lock those two doors,
yeah,
and you have a complete lockdown to secure the front of the house from backstage.
Huh. Interesting.
But it was, I think it was Andrew Weaver, who was the chair of the theater and drama department, what was then called the speech department.
Yes.
Who was a friend of the Lunts. And I believe that's how the Lunts ended up being the opening performance in the Union Theater. But I was going to say something about the lighting. Theater lighting controls now are all digital.
Yeah.
You know? When the Union Theater opened, in those days, the lighting controls were great big resistance dimmers, kind of like Tales of Tomorrow, you know, big handles going up and down and electricity sparks leaping across. But the Union Theater did not have resistance dimmers up on the stage, taking up an enormous amount of space. They had auto transformers that were downstairs in the basement and were controlled by a light board over stage right with little pins on it. This was absolutely unique and innovative at the time that the theater was built. And in fact, there was a light board on the wall, and there was a portable version of that light board with a long snake that you could plug in and operate from the front of the house if you had to. That old light board was taken out in the 70s, and Doug Taylor, who was the technical director and theater technology professor on the UW, on the theater department faculty, took that old light board and it now resides in a theater technology museum that he created.
Really?
Okay. When that light board went away in the early 70s, it was replaced by a three-scene preset. You know, and that old light board, you had to push the pins up and down. And you had different size rulers so you can move quantities of the pins simultaneously. That was replaced by a light board system in the early 70s that was also state-of-the-art, that had sliders and dimmers on it with a two- or three-scene preset.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of clunky, but that was the latest technology of the 70s. And then, of course, in the 90s, the Union Theater got itself its ETC light board.
Mm-hmm.
Well, ETC, Electronic Theater Controls, lives out in Middleton, Wisconsin. They are the world's premier builder of theater lighting, stage lighting control systems.
Is that Fred Foster?
That is Fred Foster. They are all over the planet. And Fred Foster, who is from Middleton, Wisconsin, started doing theater on the Union Theater stage in the early 70s. And in the mid-70s, late 70s, it was in that environment. He didn't build anything for the Union Theater, but he was working with that old three-scene preset. And that led him to the kind of light board design that has led his company to, you know, its world premier status. So the Union Theater has been this learning laboratory. And of course, this all goes back to Porter Butts, who said that a union is the division of social education. Remember, the Wisconsin Union is unique. It is actually a department of the university, the division of social education. And it is all premised on Porter's notion that your out-of-classroom activities are, in fact, out-of-classroom learning, with leadership responsibilities and learning opportunities. And I can't address the stuff for the union as a whole, but God only knows there are prominent and successful people in every walk of life throughout Wisconsin and the country who will tell you that the lessons they learned as programmers at the Wisconsin Union was the groundwork for what led them to their professional success in years later. On the theater, countless ongoing arts professionals, many, many, many of them on the technical side, who don't get as much notoriety as the performers, learned their basic lessons working in the Union Theater, as did I. Somebody said to me, come on down. I walked in the door, and it resulted in a lifetime of work in the arts. And that was Porter's vision, that theater would be a learning space for experiencing, but also for getting your hands on the instruments of performance and the arts. And that's what the Union Theater has been for so ever long. And it was in the context of the Wisconsin Union. And the Union, the Division of Social Education, is the context of the University of Wisconsin.
Is that still happening today, Michael?
I certainly do hope so, and I believe that that is the case. See, that kind of mission that was the underpinning of everything that happened in the Union Theater was always ongoing, whether it was overt or just kind of an unspoken but acknowledged presence. So that all the kids who worked in the Union Theater, whether they worked in the box office or they worked on stage, we
This is side two, tape four, February 22nd, 2006, Michael Goldberg.
The only sense in which the Union Theater has not operated professionally is the sense that many of the people who worked there, students, were volunteers and did not necessarily get paid for their work. But in terms of the level of work that they performed and the level of work that was expected of them, it was fully professional.
Michael, is this a good place to ask you about your work over the years with the Program Planning Committee of Students? Or does that belong elsewhere?
Yeah, it makes sense. We can touch on that. And it's a bit of a delicate issue. It's a bit of a sensitive area. So I was talking about the multifaceted nature of programming in the theater. Film programs, the lecture programs, the multiple uses that the union programmers, the union director brought into the theater. The theater was a host environment. When you go into a theater, the technical personnel provide the services you need to make your event work. Mm-hmm. In the union environment, students are the leaders. Students actually hold the purse strings and control the programming decisions. Mm-hmm. We talked about this before, that the students at the union, you know, are a majority on the union council, mm-hmm. that the students vote the budgets up and down, and then they're subject to university approval. I'm not sure how it works exactly these days. but the programming at the union, whether it's bands on the terrace or films in the play circle or exhibits in the gallery, are all student programs, student selected, student implemented, student produced, student administered. The union theater presented some special problems because the demands of programming arts seasons, which typically took place on an 18-month, two-year cycle, did not lend itself to an incoming group of freshmen in September doing a program season that ended the following May. So in general, the programmers on the Wisconsin Union Directorate who were dealing with the theater very often were 1 year out of phase. Mm-hmm. In other words, I had students who were implementing a program that their predecessors had planned and put together, and they were planning and putting together a season of programming that their successors were going to be producing the following year. Mm-hmm. But in fact, the business of putting those seasons together was not something that was easily accomplished by student programmers. So it was a challenge for all of the directors of the Union Theater, who technically worked for those student committees. The student committees were their boss. I needed the students to vote my budgets up and down, mm-hmm. for the concert series and all the rest of it. So we danced around and we tried to come to an accommodation where the students got leadership responsibilities, got decision making, and frankly the job was to illuminate the students' understanding of what it took to make the theater programmatically successful so that they would make the necessary choices. Because remember, the constituency for the programming on the Union Terrace, or in the play circle for films, or bands in the Ratskell, is other students. The constituency for Union Theater programming was the faculty and the staff and the community of Madison and all of these other non-university citizens. And frankly, there might or might not be in any given year a student programmer who really gave a hoot about chamber music or contemporary dance or whatever. So those students have to be pulled into the programming process, given ownership of the programming and decision-making, but enough leadership to understand, basically to show them where their duty lay. Mm-hmm. Now, having to do that, that balancing act, this is one of those sections of the tape where I would say, I'd rather nobody listen to this until a few years after I'm gone.
Well, you can restrict access.
Well, I'm not restricting access. It was a balancing act. It was Fan's problem, it was Dawson's, it was Ralph's, and it was mine, and it's Ralph Russo's now.
Michael,
you can burn a lot of money by doing stupid programming. The worst part is that you could drive a lot of audience away by not programming wisely, mm-hmm. and understanding that students are, well, we're going to program for our fellow students. Well, that's right, but you can't ignore the theater's responsibility and mission for programming for a whole range of stuff and a whole range of audience that may be of little or no interest to any given class of students at the university.
Michael, how were those students selected?
That's the whole Wisconsin Union Directorate program selection process, and okay. That is ongoing. I was not, basically it was y'all come. And say a little bit about student leadership on university campuses. Because remember, Porter's ideas, which went back to the 1920s and 30s, by the 60s and 70s had taken hold all over the country. There isn't a college or university in the country that doesn't have a student union. And although many of them are kind of cafetoriums and they're all, you know, Formica and neon light and, you know, and fluorescent lights, but many, many, many of them, like Cornell and Indiana, are real program unions in the mold of Porter's education concept. That's the union as the seat of out-of-classroom learning, which, of course, is very back in vogue now. Well, in some universities, student leadership, whether it's government or programming or journalism or yearbook or whatever, it's kind of a hierarchy. You get in your freshman year, and if you stick with it for 2, 3, 4 years, you might rise to the, you know, the top of the pole. That's one model, and that's true in many universities. Other universities, like the University of Wisconsin, appropriately, it's very flat. Any student could walk in the winter and late winter and early spring, and say, "I want to be applied to be the director of the film committee next year." And they did. And I also want to be applied to be the director of the Union Theater Programming Committee next year. And they did. So in the Wisconsin Union, that selection process is all managed by members of Union Council, as well as the current director, and out of their own, they also, actually, you could apply to be president of the Wisconsin Union, having never worked in the union at all, under any circumstances, as a part-time student employee, as a programmer, or anything. And I can think of at least two instances where the president of the union was someone who had no real links to the union the year before. They'd been linked to the Daily Cardinal, they were involved in other campus-related activities, they were involved with WSA, student government. WSA is now called ASM.
Associated Students, yeah, something.
Right. But you could walk in and say, "I want to be president of the union," and you would compete with other candidates on the basis of your resume and your interviews and so on. And every April, May, a new slate of program directors and president and vice presidents of the union would be installed, and that was the student leadership for the coming year. And that's the way it still is, as far as I know.
Michael, was that the most stressful part of your job, or demanded the most of your political skills in terms of working with those student programmers?
I've always said that the students were the best and the worst of it. It was always a responsibility for serving the mission. And the mission was very clear. The students are the leaders. The students are in charge. And being able to let the students be in charge and still accomplish what needed to be accomplished took a great deal of maneuvering. There's that line from Pirates of Penzance where the Major General says, "When I know more of tactics than a novice in a nunnery," you know? It wasn't quite as bad as that, but it was a challenge. The flip side, of course, is that working with students was great. For one thing, you were always right there at the front edge of what was new and changing, because every generation of students was the next emerging generation. Mm-hmm. And we used to meet once or twice every year or two and say, "All right, what's this incoming batch of students like?" And frankly, the students who were coming in the 80s were very different from the students who came in the early 90s, who were different from the ones who came to the university in the mid-90s. Anybody at a university will tell you that. Mm-hmm. You know, and whether you call them Generation X, Y, Z, or what have you, they only need the labels because these are kids who are growing up in a totally different environment from their predecessors and consequently coming to the university with a very different worldview. So it was very exciting to always have new and different. It was daunting because they were constantly changing. But of course, that was the pleasure of it. They're never the same. And you had to learn from them every single time around. Another nice thing about working at the university, of course, is you stay there in your office, and after 3 years, everybody goes away and they're replaced by a bunch of other 18 to 23-year-olds. So you look around and everybody looks like they're 18 to 23, and you think, "Well, I'm not getting any older." Of course, you're sitting there getting older every year, but these kids are all staying the same. So my student programs, they're all undergraduates, right? That's a little weird. You know, there's this little survey that I think it's Boyd College puts out every year. Things you should know about this incoming freshman class of freshmen around the country, universities around the country. And it will always say things, where we are, in 2005, 2006. So it'd say, when this student incoming freshman class comes in, they were all born after Ronald Reagan was president.
Oh, yes.
Right. And these people have never, ever played a phonograph record. They don't even know what a phonograph record is. They don't even know what a phonograph is. They've never seen one. Right? Well, they've seen turntables, so that's a step on. You know, there's that thing. So we would sit there every year and say, what do these kids know? It's common wisdom. Most incoming students, the Vietnam War is as distant for them as World War I or the Civil War, for that matter. From their perspective, being 18 years old, that's how long ago it was. They weren't born. Mm-hmm. Had no information about that. They've never seen a dial phone. They've never seen a rotary telephone. Well, they've seen one in the movies, maybe, but they've never had occasion to deal with a rotary telephone because they don't exist. You know, so, but that, those
stunning,
are just
stunning, really.
Yeah, it is. You know, and of course, as we all know, the rate of transformation of the society has been accelerating as technology moves us forward faster than it used to be moving us forward. So the students would come in every year and would say, okay, who have we got here? Also, the students were there to learn how to lead. So the program staff, very often, and this is ongoing, I'm absolutely sure, would sit there and watch what the students do and say, all right, what we're looking at here is a train wreck in the making. Do we sit back and let the train wreck happen? Or do we intercede and say, we can't let this train wreck happen? And that's the deal. That's part of the deal. I'll give you specific examples. You may remember, well, it was probably before your time at the university, the big furor at the Wisconsin Union about selling Playboy magazine at the concession stand down at the Langland Street entrance.
Before my time.
That one broke down on free speech versus respect for women. And the union council, which is a majority of students, had to decide whether or not to allow Playboy magazine to be sold at the Wisconsin Union. Now what's interesting is that, as I recall, Ted Kravitz could confirm this, in the end, they stopped selling Playboy simply because it wasn't selling. In other words, it ended up being a kind of marketplace decision. But I'll give you another version of that. Remember the big brouhaha about Nestle's selling infant formula to third world countries, and then the consequence was that women in third world countries would either mix it with polluted waters, or they would dilute it to half its strength, and there was, you know, and blah, 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 and breastfeeding is what the world is supposed to, you know, highly charged political issues. So there were boycotts on campus, and the student programmers said, Union Council said, we want the union to stop buying product from Nestle's. Well, Nestle's is the source of about two-thirds of everything that anybody eats in this country. I mean, the union, which at that time was a $12 million food enterprise, was suddenly told that the vendor from whom it bought about 50% of everything it needed in the way of materials to make food, it couldn't shop with them anymore. That was the question that was on the table. Well, who had the authority to make this decision? Frankly, it was the students. And I'll tell you something else. It was the same body of students, the directorate, who got to say, up to a point, whether or not Stuart Gordon could go out there and have his co-eds dance naked in Peter Pan. Remember that part of the conversation?
I do.
Now, in the end, Dawson stepped in and said, this cannot go on. Mm-hmm. But the basis for that was the old in loco parentis, which was actually out the window by that time.
Mm-hmm.
But what Dawson said was, if the Attorney General has said that if I let this performance take place, these students will be arrested, then I cannot let this performance take place. Mm-hmm. So he overstepped his boundaries, but there was one of those balancing acts where the students said, they're naked, so what? It's a play, let them do it. The Attorney General said, if they do it, I'm going to bust them. Dawson said, then I can't let it happen. Up until then, Dawson said, I will defend to the death their right to do this play. Now, not everybody who was there saw it that way. I don't want to go back to the Peter Pan business.
Right.
But really what I'm trying to say is that in the context of the Wisconsin Union, and Ted Crabb will verify this, and Mark Guth here will tell you now, philosophically, but also on a day-to-day basis, Porter's principles still prevail, that the students are in charge. And at the Union Theater, technically, they got to vote the program budgets up and down. But on a year-to-year basis, about 60% of what the union was programming, the students didn't have any interest in. They could care less about the travel films. They weren't much interested in classical music. A few of them were, but that was very rare. They wanted to do pop music. They wanted to do rock and roll. They wanted to do the stuff that was interest to them and their peers. Mm-hmm. So creating an environment where the students really were getting that out-of-classroom learning experience, how to be a presenter, how to run a theater, so on, was a challenge. It was easier with the techies, the ones who wanted to learn how to run a box office or to be a stagehand, because you're stagehand, you get to do stage work, whether you're doing a dance event, a rock and roll event, or a chamber music recital. But if you want to be a programmer, and it was the whole equation, it wasn't just I get to pick the artist, then you got to sell the show, and you got to pay the bills.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a learning curve, too, because remember, performing arts and entertainment in general, highly speculative enterprise.
Michael, how much of your budget did you have to earn? How important was ticket revenue?
Technically, the Union Theater had to show a break-even or better budget.
Uh-huh.
Now, the Union Theater was an anomaly as presenting arts, as presenting facilities go, and that budget didn't reflect anybody's salaries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because remember, the finances of the Union Theater were very, very convoluted. If you wanted to look at them and say, what are the Union Theater's finances, you'd have a very difficult time teasing out the relationships. For example, the Union Theater has no custodial budget. All the custodial services for the Union Theater are provided by the Wisconsin Union custodial budget. On the other hand, except for salaries, the Union Theater box office has to recover, I believe, the cost of running a box office. Okay? Programmatically, the shows themselves, the concert series and the rest of them, they either had to make enough money to break even, and they didn't have to absorb a lot of production, a lot of administrative overhead, but they either had to break even, or you had to find dollars to support it. That's one of the reasons that the Theater Endowment Fund started to come together in the 70s and the 80s to provide a source of underwriting so that money could be raised to support union programming. It was also very hard for programming at the Union Theater to get state arts agency or other foundation grants. Remember in Wisconsin, which has, depending on how you determine it, the 47th or the 49th smallest per capita support of the arts of any state in the union, the university is also supported by the state. Of course, it's now a minuscule portion of what it used to be, thanks to our esteemed leadership at the legislature of the block. When I came to Madison, the university was getting 60% of its budget from the state.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's like under 30%, like 28% or something.
No, it's 20. 20. 21, 22.
Fine. As if the state and the citizens of the state were not still the biggest beneficiaries. And these guys are paying, you know, they're putting in 20% of the budget, but they're nickel and diming every decision.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's a different subject. Don't get me started. But the point is that when the Union Theater would go to the State Arts Board, the people on the Arts Board reviewing the grants would say, well, wait a minute. Why would the State Arts Agency want to give money to arts programming at the university? Why isn't the university giving money to state to arts programming? It's state dollars.
Mm-hmm.
Where is that coming from? So it's tricky business. We were able to get dollars when we could put together what were overtly projects that really served. Also, they didn't like to give money to projects that served university students. So state arts agency money and arts council money should go, for a program that could serve non-university students. So our good work and our good programming on behalf of students who, for some reason or other, were not perceived as worthy recipients of state arts agency funding because they were at the university, and supposedly the university was taking care of their needs.
Oh.
Now, you kind of got me off on a tirade here. But my recollection at the time was going out and looking for bucks was very difficult, and we had to exist within our budget in-house. So the union did what it has typically done, and effectively and traditionally and for good reason, it turned to their constituents. They turned to the union programmers, the generations of Wisconsin Union directorate members who go right back to 1939 and are now in their 80s and 90s, the ones that aren't deceased, and all years in between, and who've gone on to professional success. And when you go to somebody like Barb Manley, or you go to Carol Skornica, or you go to Matt Heffernan, and you say, will you give to the Wisconsin Union? They say, holy smokes, everything I ever became was seeded in my union leadership experience. So the union has had some success. Well, you know better than I do that as constituencies go, when the UW Foundation is looking for contributed dollars, those union constituents step up pretty big time. They don't necessarily step up in the gigantic amounts that a Chazen might on a one-shot, but cumulatively, their commitment is mind-boggling.
With great passion.
Yes.
I mean, their commitment, I would say, has to be, if not at the very top, very close to it,
yeah.
Michael. Very passionate.
Yeah. And that's because, again, because Porter's idea was the right idea.
Mm-hmm.
And so many of them who were not necessarily even connected with the Union Theater, although, you know, the running joke at the Foundation is Barb and Frank Manley met when she was the chair of the theater committee and Frank was an usher.
Oh, I didn't know that story.
But even for many of them who weren't involved with the theater per se, see, it's one of the sad things for me is that the extent to which students went to union theater programs diminished greatly in the 70s and 80s and 90s. And that really had a lot to do with the change in what was perceived as culture. See, the union theater went on doing chamber music and dance events and the arts, but students turned away in droves and went looking for rock and roll and pop music and agitprop theater, and basically what did and didn't happen to union theater audiences mirrors what really changed in culture between the 60s and the 90s and on into the present. The same audiences that are contributing to the demise of symphony orchestras are the same ones that in the 50s and 60s used to pack the Union Theater and the Field House to hear the Boston Symphony.
Mm-hmm.
But that's another part of the conversation. Now the Union Theater still has, as I understand it from Ralph, the same commitment to making as great as possible the participation of the union programmers in the programming process,
mm-hmm.
program selection, program implementation. And I got to give Ralph credit because he's been much more successful than I remember myself being in making the programming look more and more like what the students wanted it to look like. I was a little constipated in my approach to programming. I was so anxious to preserve that core of concert series subscribers, and I didn't want to lose the credibility for being an arts venue,
mm-hmm.
you know, doing important artwork. And it was important to some students, but the Wendy Eckerts and the Bill T. Joneses and the Aiko and Comas and the Meredith Monks mattered to segments of the university, but in very small numbers.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't ever matter to large segments of the campus population. They never would. They didn't matter to large segments of the general population. Why would they? Hopefully they'd be a little stronger on campus, but in the end, proportionally, the number of students who could care less about really great jazz is equal to the percentage of people in the population who could care less about really great jazz.
Mm-hmm.
So programming really great jazz was a pretty hard sell to the student programmers of the Union Directorate Theater Committee.
Michael, would you bring in proposals to them?
Yeah, I would bring the students to the booking conference. I would, as I said, I'd try to show them where the programming activity was that spoke to the theater's traditions and past and current constituents. And in fairness, my student program, I had great student programmers. I had 23 years of student programmers. I told you before, at least half a dozen of them are now colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
They're professional colleagues who've gone on to do this kind of work in other environments. It's another funny irony, too. This is really kind of curious. The union and the university in general, and the union in particular, of course, always had this mandate of a commitment to affirmative participation, multiracial, multi-ethnic participation. And one of the union's problems over the years is that the union was kind of white.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a big secret that the African American community on campus struggles that it has unto its own is rightly kind of, you know, they hang together.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is that prominent or outstanding student leaders of color were in everybody's crosshairs. Everybody wanted them. Hey, we got 9 black students on campus. How'd you like to join our organization? How'd you like to be the president of our fraternity? How'd you like to be on the union direct, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I have no experience of what it's like to be a black student. All I know is that black students were scarce, just like in corporate America and every place else. And the people who wanted to honor a commitment and obligation to be participatory, to be welcoming, they were after everybody. Well, ironically, in 23 years, I had 23 directorate theater committee directors.
Mm-hmm.
5 of whom were black and 2 of whom were Asian.
Wow. That's quite phenomenal.
Yeah, there was Laura Schaefer, who's living in Milwaukee now, is an actress. There was Brittany Reed, who graduated just a couple of years ago. What's her name, who's up now running a world travel agency in the Twin Cities, who was in for the funeral last month. Alicia Keaton, who was the president during the union's theater's 50th anniversary year, 89-90,
mm-hmm.
who is an attorney now in Indianapolis. I mean, it's really kind of odd. It's kind of amazing, too, in a way.
Yeah.
But it was just a fluke. But
not entirely, Michael. Some of it is the tone you set.
Well, some of it is the tone, but some of it, go back to the recruitment process. I never went looking for the new incoming directors. The program staff had, other than administering the process, and that was only some of the program staff, we had nothing to do with that recruitment. The students
people knew who you were.
No, I think it was that people knew, there were people like Brittany and Laurie were drawn to the theater. See, they were drawn to the Union Theater because it was the place where performance, where theater and dance happened. Now remember, the Union Theater, I said, was used 300 plus days a year. Only, I don't think even 40, 45, maybe 55% of what happened there was actual performance. The rest of it were all these lectures and conferences and, you know, convocations and forums and all the rest of it. But these kids came to the Union Theater because they were interested in show business. They liked the arts, they liked performance, and that's why they wanted to be connected to the Union Theater.
Mm-hmm.
And every year, I would work, all the other director program staff, the Union program staff, would work with their students, but it was difficult for me because I would watch my colleagues on the program staff simply hand over the whole program function to their directors, try to kind of monitor it so it didn't go off the rails.
Mm-hmm.
I had to take those students into the Union Theater enterprise and educate them to what it was and how it worked and how it was not only for students, it was for a much, much larger constituency. And that 3 out of every 5 days a week, 4 out of every 7, that theater was not going to be used by students. It was going to be used by the College of Agriculture or Tampa Press or UW Extension or whatever. Yes, it's your theater. But a theater is everybody's when they need it.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody's when they need it. And they got that too.